Greetings, listeners. We're back with another Dragons and Jive episode. Herman from Harlem over here with Billy from the Bronx, or I don't know my New York locales that well, but we're firmly set in New York, as most of the Marvel Universe is, and we're back with talking some Luke Cage, some Shang-Chi, and he's gone far afield now, I should say. He's not in New York any longer. And then, of course, Iron Fist. Billy, how are you doing, man?
Not too bad. I'm looking for some suckers that need a beating, and I'm going to shit out when I find them.
Yeah, you're not going to be disappointed, listeners, here, because a lot of folks get their noses bloodied by steel hard fists, by iron fists, and by the heels of Fu Manchu's least favorite son. Only son.
Yep.
So it's going to be fun talking about these comics. So specifically, since we're now on episode 5 of Dragons and Jive, we're going to be talking Master of Kung Fu number 20, Marvel Premiere number 19, starring Iron Fist, and Hero for Hire number 5, of course, starring our hero from Harlem, Luke Cage. I always get that screwed up now that I mentioned that, Billy, like Hell's Kitchen and Harlem. When I was a kid, I thought Hell's Kitchen was, a nickname for Harlem. I didn't know why, but Daredevil is based in Hell's Kitchen, right? Or he's the protector of Hell's Kitchen. Luke is in Harlem. Yes. So, I don't know how familiar you are with New York, but are they adjacent to each other? I mean, these neighborhoods?
Well, I am no New York City expert at all, and I've never been to Harlem that I'm aware of. You get lost, you never know where you are. But I have been through Hell's Kitchen, that's like, the very southern part of Manhattan there. So
I have
been through there at night, too, and it looks a little creepy.
Okay, so, probably not near enough. Because, the only places the reason why I might know a little bit of New York is because a long time ago I used to play that Spider-Man game on the PS3, I think it was Spider-Man 3, even. Oh, man, they had an accurate New York there. And, of course, these days they have newer Spider-Man games, but I've long since given up gaming. Mm-hmm. So, I'm swinging through the city way back when, 10 years gone, probably, and I sort of memorized every place. But, I can't remember swinging through Harlem or through, Hell's Kitchen. Only the Bronx, of course, with Spidey being based there at times. So, but fun times, though. But Luke, firmly, hero from Harlem. And, of course, we've got some great stories lined up for you, patrons of the weird. So, Billy, we're doing the same where we're giving a bit of details about the issues, and then we'll launch into our synopses, which is our Twitter-style summary of each of these issues. And we should mention, though, before we start, that Master of Kung Fu being first on the slate, we skipped an issue, but not really, because we've done Master of Kung Fu number 19. During our, previous Into the Weird episode on our regular feed. Mm-hmm. And so, obviously, now, if you want to do it chronologically and you want to go back and re-listen and you want to find out where Shang-Chi is at the moment, you can do so. But we'll also make it easier for you, right, Billy? We'll quickly give a recap of issue 19. Mm-hmm. So, basically, Shang-Chi just foiled Fu Manchu's plans and blew up his shipping tanker full of mimosa, the drug that he's peddling in the States. And he's still on the Florida coast. So he's near the swamplands. And we know what swamp creature hangs out in the Marvel Universe, in the Florida Everglades at times. And Shang-Chi, is trying to escape while his hands are bound from these two assassins, Dekim and Jahar, that Fu Manchu has set on his trail to get revenge on his son for messing up his scheme here to addle the minds of the folks in the States with the mimosa drug. But Shang-Chi himself is suffering from an addled brain because he had a whiff of the mimosa. And so he has to deal with these two highly trained assassins while having his hands tied behind his back and while being woozy all the time. And then who does he encounter in the swamps, Billy?
Well, that would be our boy Man-Thing.
That's right. And then we get that classic scene of Shang-Chi, obviously this being a Marvel comic, he has to, even though there are two good guys meeting up, they have to engage in a bit of fisticuffs. and their altercation leads Shang-Chi to leap and embed himself in the Man-Thing's body. That's a classic scene. And then this David Carradine-like character, Su Lun, he shows up. But he's decidedly Asian, more Asian than David Carradine could ever hope to be. And he,
for real.
sort of saves Shang-Chi, So he pulls him right through the mossy form of the Man-Thing and then gives him shelter. Deku and Jar show up again. Shang-Chi this time bests them, but because of some bad luck, he's almost killed by one of the assassins, and then Man-Thing shows up. And then, you know, whatever knows fear, what happens when you fear around the Man-Thing, Billy?
Oh, you're going to get cooked. And that one panel of those guys, whoa, that is so good.
Looked like they were having a southern-style barbecue there with Man-Thing just killing these two assassins in this conflagration. And boom, that's it for them. Charred corpses in the swamp. And, then Shang-Chi, goes on his way, and Man-Thing, you know, returns to the nexus of all realities. A fun issue of a Marvel team-up between the Master of Kung Fu and the Master of the Mossy Everglades. So that's where we pick it up. Now, Billy, I'm going to give some details about the issue. You're going to go first with the synopsis. Master of Kung Fu number 20 was published in 1974, cover dated September of 1974, but on sale June the 18th. And it was a 25-cent cover price, 32 pages, edited by Roy Thomas, and cover art by Gil Kane and Frank Giacoya. The title is one of probably the best story titles in Marvel from the 70s. I love this title. It's also the title of the recent Shang-Chi collection, you know, the Epic Collection, chronicling the first dozen issues of his run. That's been recently released, Weapon of the Soul. And that's the one you have, right, Billy, if I'm not mistaken?
Yeah, I actually have 19, 20, 22. I have a bunch of issues in the 20s. I have the single issue, too. So I'm checking that out because, you know, I always would rather, you know, prefer to read it that way.
Yeah, true. Yeah, me too. I do crack my Master of Kung Fu comics open more often than others. You know, I find I just love rereading them, but I have some of the omnibuy, but the omnibuses they're very unwieldy for me. I'd rather not take them off the shelf, and I'd rather crack open an issue, and that's saying something. It's just I got to find a place to put the omnibus. I put it on a bit of a reading table so that it's at an angle to read. You know, I can't put it on my lap, no way. So it's better for me to just, you know, take the old issues out. And you know, the writer here, of course, is again Doug Munch, and we're firmly...
Oh, wait a minute.
Yep.
This one's actually Jerry Conway.
That's right. Sorry, Jerry Conway. Hey, that
did
means...
Did a fill-in here.
That means for the first time ever, Mike's Amazing World has an error here, because I got my information off of Mike's Amazing World. They say Doug Munch is the writer. Oof. All right, so you're right. In the comic book, which I'm looking at now, of course, Jerry Conway wrote this fill-in writer at this point in time. But we'll see more of Munch when we get to Marvel Premiere. And, So, basically, penciled by Paul Gulacy, this is when he started his legendary run. Well, he started it an issue earlier, but, you know, we're firmly in he's the master leading us along, showing us all these gorgeous images, right, Billy? Paul Gulacy is a legend. And then inked by Al Milgrom, lettered by Dave Hunt, and colored by George Roussos. Okay, and we mentioned where you can find this reprinted in Shang-Chi Omnibus Volume 1, as well as the Weapon of the Soul trade paperback collection. But Marvel has it on their Marvel app, and of course Comixology has it as well. So, Billy, what is your summary of this very fun and fantastically written and penciled issue?
All right, so Shang-Chi wants peace, but it seems he cannot have it. After two of his father's top assassins were burned alive by the Man-Thing, he's attacked by three men on a beach, but not by the man from sent by Fu Manchu. These are sent by a hood named Danny Marston, who wants Shang-Chi dead, and he ends up hiring a sword-wielding killer named Karan to do the deed.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly the plot. So not a lot of intricacies here when it comes to the storyline, right, Billy? It's fairly straightforward. Shang-Chi is a target of, you know, this Marston guy, and then he sends some assassins. So this is not really a Fu Manchu-fueled issue, although there is a tie to Demi Marston and Fu Manchu a little bit. I mean, he wants to get into Fu Manchu's good books by assassinating his son. All right, mine goes as follows. On a Miami beach, Shang-Chi is attacked by scuba assassins and learns that gambling king Demi Marston wants him dead. Heading to Marston's palatial floating casino, he rips through a bunch of goons like a gale through confetti and comes face to face with the samurai Karain. Hopped up on Fu Manchu's elixir of life, Karain proves a difficult foe. Will Shang-Chi come out holding all the aces, or has he been dealt a bad hand? It's Kung Fu action meets Casino Royale.
<There's> that good one.
James Bond angle again. Because, he's already leaning towards the espionage stories that the series would become well known for. And lots of action again, Billy. I mean, these Shang-Chi issues almost have more action than a regular Marvel comic. You know, from the Bronze Age, I would say. And, you know, a fight would normally last sometimes pages. Almost like, you know, if you were reading a Frank Miller Daredevil comic or a Lone Wolf and Cub. You know, where they have these protracted battle sequences, which I love. Shang-Chi's similar to that. So let's speak about the cover from Gil Kane here and Frank Chiaquila. What do you think of about the cover?
I like it. You know, it's got a lot going on because there's one, two, three, four, five, you know, guys here attacking Shang-Chi, which, you know, you can just tell by the way it looks that four of them are just, you know, goons. And but the other guy is certainly not. And it says, "Watch out, Shang-Chi, here comes the death-dealing samurai." So yeah, I like this one quite a bit.
Yeah, I'm the same. I think Gil Kane, you know, he's really good at drawing these acrobatic-like characters. And Shang-Chi being one of the most agile of the bunch, you know, that Gil Kane is normally drawing in the 70s here, he does it well. So, you know, I have no gripes with him on covers, as we've spoken about before. I love Gil Kane's covers, just his interiors that I sometimes find weird. But, you know, we love weird. Weird is good. So I don't know exactly why I should have this, you know, dislike of Kane. But, you know, Billy, I like the fact that, you know, Shang-Chi is always shown in these early issues and on the covers as taking on multiple opponents. You know, and most of the time they're highly trained. I mean, sometimes they're a biker gang, you know, like in the very first issue. Then he can take on 20 of them at the same time. But here, you know, highly trained assassins plus a samurai, no match for our boy Shang. So this is a great bit of art here by Gulacy. On the very first page, we get these three panels. And even though Shang-Chi looks a little bit awkward there in the bottom panel with that kick, you know, I kind of find it, you know, very satisfying panel. You know, because of the effect of that kick, you can feel there's some real weight behind the art there and that kick impacting with that guy's, the scuba assassin's mouth. And isn't that a great first panel where Shang-Chi just stands on the beach and stares out at the sun setting in Florida?
It's great. Yeah, a couple of palm trees and, you know, the Miami city there on the far left, you can see a couple of buildings there. Oh, it's fantastic. And like you said, three panels, and the next one you walk in a little bit and then you see those goons coming out of the water, and then that third, you know, panel, which is like half the page, he starts kicking the crap out of them.
Yeah, I mean, they're all real daggers. And now, Billy, this is the reason they lost. You never fight on a beach with flippers. They're wearing flippers and scuba suits.
Yeah.
How, I mean, I can't even walk properly with flippers, man. Now, these dudes are trying to attack a master of Kung Fu with flippers, and the first two assassins are taken out double quick, right?
Quite easily.
The one even kills himself by impaling himself on his knife when Shang-Chi dodges his lunge. And then the second one, what happened? Oh, yeah, the first one, sorry, I should say, was just kicked in the face by Shang-Chi, so he's down for the count, probably dead.
He KO'd. Yeah, right in the jaw, he kicked him. Yeah.
And then the third one seems more experienced, though. He's waiting, watching, assessing Shang-Chi's skill level, and then he attacks. But, you know, still proves no match for Shang-Chi. He just dodges the guy's jump. And this seems to be the go-to sort of move for these scuba divers, to leap headlong at you, mm-hmm. pointing the knife straight, like a rocket, right? Like mm-hmm. that Marvel superhero from ROM that we'll meet soon, Torpedo. You remember yeah. him?
That guy, yeah.
Shang-Chi just...
He's a goof.
Oh, he's a goofball. Shang-Chi dodges, you know, hits him in the solar plexus and then kicks him in the nuts.
I was going to say, yep, right with the low blow. Boom.
Ooh, but the guy recovers well. You know, he's
pissed. Yeah.
Ridiculously agile. He lands on his palm, on his, what is that, his right hand, flips over, mm-hmm. and he's ready for more. He's bleeding from the mouth, though. Shang-Chi just ignores him and folds his arms. You know, and then mm-hmm. Shang-Chi was kind of impressed with the guy's skill level, but then once he starts talking, Shang-Chi says he's a fool because he speaks. Oh, I love that part. So, Billy, what happens then? I mean, this guy keeps shouting at Shang-Chi, "I don't like that, little man. I don't like that at all." What happens to the poor doofus?
Oh, yeah, well, he blocks a couple of punches and knocks the knife out of his hand and then smashes the guy's, you know, goggles and face in it with a huge punch. And Shang-Chi says, "You made two mistakes, assassin. First, you spoke, and this distracted you. Second, you became angry, and this dulled your mind."
Exactly. That's why what he referred to when he called the guy a fool once he started to speak. Mm-hmm. It's a sign of weaklings. Well, at least in Shang-Chi's experience. And from all mm-hmm. the trainers he's had. So that's why Shang-Chi is normally silent. You know, when he says something, it's something mm-hmm. poignant. It's not going to be, you know, these little platitudes like his foes are used to uttering. Yeah. But, you know, it seems that he injured the guy. I mean, he obviously punched him in the face and cracked his goggles. And that laid mm-hmm. him down. But it seems like he also injured the guy's shoulder somehow with some kind of, you know, Gong Fu trick there, you know, when he blocked the knife mm-hmm. or something, because he mm-hmm. says he can alleviate the pain. And, you know, he gets some information from this assassin who says it's Demi Marston, the casino mm-hmm. king from Florida, who sent him after Shang to kill him. And then Shang-Chi, in fact, does relieve the pain with this, you know, I don't know, what is this, chi blocking, or, you know, he uses some advanced form of a massage on this guy's shoulder, kind of like Mr. Miyagi in the Karate Kid movies, right?
Pressure points or something to help him out or something.
He leaves the pain and the guy just sinks into mm-hmm. unconsciousness. Now, Demi Marston's ship is called the Sweet Home. This, I don't know if it's actually a yacht. It also looks like kind of like a cargo ship or a giant cruise ship, really.
Yeah.
It's way too big to be a yacht. And it's got this giant casino inside. So, yeah, it must be like a cruise ship. So this guy's rich, but he wants to kill Shang-Chi so that Fu Manchu will notice him. So he's informed by one of his, you know, servants that, you know, they failed, the scuba assassins. So he's going to...
Buford.
Yeah, Buford. Yeah, what a name, right?
Goofball.
Yeah, he looks kind of like, you know, Mr. Hyde, you know, from the Marvel, you know... What's Dr. Calvin Voorhees?
Zabo.
Yeah. Zabo. Calvin Zabo, sorry. Calvin Zabo. I was thinking about Jason Voorhees here with Halloween on the mind.
I'll say we're getting too close to Halloween
here. Yeah, you're right. Calvin Zabo and Mr. Hyde. He looks like a thinner, more leaner Mr. Hyde with a little bit of Sebastian Shaw in there.
I was just going to say, one of the people from the Hellfire Club. Yep. Yeah,
that's right. That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't know what Demi Marston's got going on, but he's got a bit of a Bee Gees look to his attire. And then his head looks typical Paul Gulacy, you know, kind of features or James Bond villain-esque, you know, kind of look. But youngish, you know, and he looks inexperienced. He looks like, you know, Shang-Chi's going to make mincemeat of him, which is, in fact, going to happen. We're not spoiling anything here. But, Billy, what happens once his paramour... Diana walks into the room.
Yeah, this guy's insane. So this beautiful woman comes in and she says, you know, about Buford, "Is he gone, lover?" He says, "Go back on deck, Diana. I'm thinking." She says, "Couldn't help hearing you, Demi. This kid's got you down, doesn't he?" And he says, "Not now, Diana. I told you I'm thinking." And she starts trying to put the moves on him, and he turns around and like cracks her right across the face and like busts her mouth open. She says she's bleeding and everything, and he's like, "Get out." And he tries to act all tough. But then after she does leave, he has this face on, and I don't know if it's supposed to be conveying that, you know, he's like, you know, sorry for what he did, or he just, you know, puts on this tough act, but he's really knows he's a turd, or he's worried about Shang-Chi or what, but he has a face on like, you know, there's something not going right here, even though he tried to act all big and tough in front of her.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, exactly why. I think he instantly regretted it, maybe because later on he's gonna apologize to her, you know, for hitting her. It could also be that the fact that he said he listens to nobody is not in fact true, because he wants to become a servant of Fu Manchu, so he's gonna be subservient to Fu Manchu once his plan succeeds. Maybe that's why he regrets saying that. But, you know, be that as it may, he still goes along with the plan to kill Shang-Chi. And to do that, they need this ultimate samurai assassin called Karain. And they visit him in his little pagoda-like island structure there that he has. This guy's rich because he's an assassin. And he also has a successful assassin, I should say. He has some ties to Fu Manchu as well, as we hinted at in our synopses. So, Buford and... you know, the captain of this little speedboat, probably the captain of the cruise ship as well. They show up at Corain's home, and what happens? The first page we see Corain is a couple of panels of ridiculous, you know, skill. Now speak on that, Billy. What does he do?
These two goofballs like approach him, and he says, "I am Corain," and he pulls this sword out and slices the guy's tie right off of his neck and his shirt open, and then just all in one motion, and then drops the sword right into its sheath, like, whoosh, all in one motion. It's great.
Yeah, so don't approach Corain with a tie, man. He hates ties, because he's going to sever that sucker. And he didn't just, you know, sever the tie. He cut open the guy's shirt as well, and you see Buford's kind of ripped, you know, with the shirt hanging off of him. But Corain himself, not a traditional looking samurai. I mean, even the sword he's wielding isn't a katana.
No.
Or the sword that samurais typically use. He kind of has this blue and yellow costume-like effect going on with some armor, but most of his body's bare, and then he's got this traditional samurai looking helmet. And highly skilled, of course. And they show him the picture of Shang-Chi. And then it ends part one, Weapon of the Soul. And so he's firmly committed to killing Shang-Chi, more of because it might be a challenge, because they do mention that it's the son of Fu Manchu. So I think that's probably why he took the job, right, Billy?
Because he thinks he's the best, and he knows the son of Fu Manchu would be a pretty tough opponent. So he's like, all right.
Yeah, and he also probably knows that Fu Manchu wants his son dead, too. I mean, the word's been out for a while now that Shang-Chi betrayed his father. And then there's this great opening page to part two, Poison of the Soul. And I love the lettering there. And this is nighttime. Yeah. Shang-Chi's stealing aboard the Home Sweet Home cruise ship, Demi's casino, floating casino, by climbing up the anchor. It's awesome, and listen to Jerry Conway did some good writing here. You know, he says,
well,
yeah, what do you think?
If you notice in the issue, part two now says Doug Mensch.
Okay,
so I think, you know, maybe he was only like halfway done, and then, you know, Conway did the first part, and then Doug Mensch got it in the second part here. But yeah, I love this. It's a gorgeous scene.
Yeah, it might be because of some deadlines that they got Jerry.
I would bet money.
Yeah, I'm surprised they didn't get Bill Mantlo, you know, because he's normally the pinch hitter. Yeah, but he probably wasn't available at this time. So, yeah, you're right. This is Doug Mensch and not Jerry Conway's words. You're right, Billy. Thanks for correcting me there. And it's great. Do you want to read that to us, that the first... I mean, this is Shang-Chi's thoughts. This is his direct thoughts we're privy to.
Yeah, this is him thinking, "It is gray, an alien, a cold, hard intruder to the grace and serenity of this, that which it displaces. Seen here in the silent darkness deeper than night, seen here below the tranquil water, above the sea, it rises." And of course, you know, the panel progression, each time, you know, there's a different word, it, you know, kind of coincides with what Shang-Chi's actually doing as well. So yeah, pretty cool.
Yeah, when he's in the water, the panel says water. When he's climbing up the anchor, it says above the sea. And when he, you know, climbs onto the cruise ship, it says it rises. So it's fantastic. And then, you know, he finds these goons having a bit of a drinking fest, smoking cigars. Mm-hmm. They're in their holiday shirts there, and he just walks by them. He completely ignores them, dripping wet. And the fact that he ignores them angers them, right?
the one meathead. Where does he think he's slinking to? Yeah. They paid us to keep outsiders out.
They're not doing a very good job, man. So these guys accost Shang-Chi with guns, but that doesn't matter to Shang-Chi. He just... The one guy, he takes his head and he slams him onto his knee. So, you know, he's descending and the knee is rising and meets his face. That guy's down for the... He should be down for the count, but still, he's up and walking in the next couple of panels, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then Shang-Chi's faster than their trigger fingers, easily, right? He, before this guy could blast him away, kicks the guy in the face, grabs the... while doing that, right, he wraps his arm around the other guy's neck. And a gunshot hasn't even been heard yet. There's nothing. And that's how fast he moves. And what do you think he did with the guy that he eventually tossed into the ocean? Looks like he's going to kill him there, right? He's about to give him a open-handed, flat-handed blow to the neck or something?
Yeah, as the meathead saying, "Hey, stop this maniac. He's strangling me. He's..." And then that's all you see is Shang-Chi, like, with his arm up, like he's going to come down and crush the guy's windpipe and then... plosh into the water, and then the other two dudes are laying there dead, and the one still had his cigar in his mouth, and it's now laying there.
Yeah, it's probably their guns that he tossed into the water, and the three guys are still on the deck, but yeah, they're down for the count.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Injured, might be dead, you never know. I mean, Shang-Chi, you know, we've mentioned this before, he doesn't mind killing, you know. In fact, he's a trained killer, so it probably comes very easily to him. And then Demi's in the casino pawing Diana and apologizing, and then some water drips on his hand. And Shang-Chi's still dripping wet, just standing over him, dripping on him, and saying, "You are Demi Marston. Why do you wish me dead?" So this Demi Marston can't believe this, right? So he just excuses himself from the table and then shouts at the top of his lungs, and sweat is pouring from his brow, right, Billy? He realizes there's some trouble. It's him. It's the kid, Shang-Chi. Take him. Johnny, Chino. Chino, where are you? Where the devil? And old Chino's already sprawled on the ground. Shang-Chi's already been taking out his henchmen silently.
But then I love how in that last panel with the guy laying there dead or knocked out or whatever, you see somebody's leg. And we know it's Karain.
That's right. Karain discovered Shang-Chi's handiwork already. So Karain's here with his armored calf, his armored shin. But, you know, that doesn't matter because right now it's Demi Marston versus Shang-Chi. He tries to blow Shang-Chi away, but again, Shang-Chi dodges a bullet. And then Spider-Man style, right? He just kicks the gun out of Demi's hand and also seems to injure Demi severely. It looks like his arm's been snapped there, you know, at the angle that it's been twisted at. And then Karain cuts through the door leading to this part of the casino.
Yeah.
I mean, with the samurai blade of his. And then they recognize this is the master assassin now engaging the son of Fu Manchu. What do you think about that splash page, Billy?
Oh, my gosh. So good. Oof. It's really good as he's like busting through this door and like jumping downwards towards them. Oh, it's crazy good.
Oh man, it's great.
And then Shang-Chi knows him, so it's great too. I like that.
Yeah, he says he remembers the man, an assassin of unsurpassed skill, a samurai. He was respected in his father's court in Hunan, and that's why this guy's legend. But then Shang-Chi also figures something out during the battle as he dodges these twin blades now that Karain's wielding. Right, he's got a sword in each hand, and Shang-Chi, man, if I had to pick anyone to fight for my life, it would be Shang-Chi, you know, because this guy, it doesn't matter what weapons you bring to the table, he's unarmed, he'll probably go out on top, you know, at the end, get out on top, because he can dodge sword blades, bullets, you know, it doesn't matter. So even though Karain's this master assassin, he's in the prime of his life because of, we'll find out later, the elixir of life that Fu Manchu's gifted him. But, you know, this elixir has some terrible after effects, and eventually it'll also affect Fu Manchu. Because if you take the elixir too much, right, Billy, you become dependent on it. And the more you take, the more you need to maintain your youth. And this is exactly now what's plaguing Corain. Shang-Chi realizes that this guy must be old as hell, because when he was a kid, the guy was already old, you know, in Fu Manchu's court. So that's why he realizes there's something up. And what happens during the battle?
Yeah, the guy is, you know, getting ready to go for a killing blow here. And then all of a sudden he grabs his chest and he's like, ah. But then we see he starts turning into like this ancient old dude. He almost looks reptilian.
Yeah.
And then he says, the elixir, must drink the elixir. And then Shang-Chi, of course, is freeing himself because he had been kind of pinned to the wall by one of the swords. And he sees this guy's, you know, basically this guy can be defeated because he's just this really old dude. And, you know, obviously if you depend on that elixir, you know, and then it gives him a little bit of time here to think of a game plan. And then the guy drinks the elixir and he comes charging at Shang-Chi. And then what happens? Oof.
Ooh, okay. This is, okay. The fact that he drank the entire bottle of elixir, you know, to deal with Shang-Chi during this fight, this was too much for his heart, right, Billy? Yeah. So Shang-Chi can even hear the frantic beating of the heart from across the room after he drank that bottle. So his heart's going to burst. Shang-Chi realizes that he's a dead man from having, you know, taken that swig of the entire bottle. And then he leaps at Shang-Chi, obviously meaning to leap over this pool table, or this card table, I should say. But then he doesn't manage it because his heart gives out and he falls flat on his chest on this card table, and one of his swords goes flying from his hand. And what happens then, Billy?
Oh, it goes right into the like abdomen of Diana and kills her. It's awful.
Yeah, that is a terrible scene. And then it seems that Demi really loved her, even though he was this, woman-beating scum. Mm-hmm. And he shouts, Diana, my God, Diana, you know, forgive me. I did it for you. You know, I knew Fu Manchu wanted his son dead. I thought he'd reward me if I arranged Shang-Chi's death. So Shang-Chi just walks away. He's like, okay, you got what you had coming to you. And Moraine's dead. But he still leaves us with a bit of a thought. He says, in his mind, he thinks, nature has attained a cruel balance. Death, right? Death has arrived late for one and prematurely for another. You know, so there is a bit of balance in there, right?
Yeah, it's crazy, though. Oof. That panel, man. You see Diana laying there with the sword sticking out of her, and then Corain there laying over the table dead. It's pretty bad.
Yeah, man, that final panel, it's a scene of devastation left in Shang-Chi's wake. So don't mess with the son of Fu Manchu, man.
Yeah, you
know, big mistake, Demi. You probably won't make that mistake ever again, but he might if he's stupid. He might want revenge. It's not gonna work, Demi. Now this is a terrible panel, and it's even more terrible the fact that it's bloodless. Right, Billy, we know that there's probably blood gushing from the wound. They opt not to show that, but that makes it even more terrible. I mean, there is a little bit of blood in the final panel. You know, the black kind of inky kind of blood pooling onto the carpet there. But the initial, you know, strike of the blade, it just looks like it went into her belly button. You know, it's like horrible.
Yeah, it's rough.
Ooh, so a sad ending there because Diana wasn't innocent. And you know, not Shang-Chi's doing, though, because it was Corain. You know, Shang-Chi didn't even deliver a blow that caused this accident. And then next issue, murder at Marine Land. You know, so we see Shang-Chi still in Florida, still trying to get back to... But we're going to see more of Demi. You know, he's not going to let it go. You know, Billy, that's why I'm talking about this guy's not the brightest bulb, you know, in the chandelier here, because... yeah, he's going to be blame Shang-Chi for the death of, even though it's clearly Demi who caused it. And you know what you've got to look forward to, patrons, is Shang-Chi versus Jaws. Shang-Chi versus a giant-ass shark in the next episode of Dragons and Jive. I mean, we're in Florida. Come on. Bring on the creature features here. So that's going to be fun, right, Billy?
Oh my gosh, yeah, it's insane.
Okay, this is a favorite of mine. I love this issue that we just discussed, but we're heading on to another favorite of ours, and that, of course, is Mr. Cage, the hero for hire. Luke. All right, so Billy, do you have the details for this particular issue?
Yeah, this one's Luke Cage number 5, like we said, from January 1973, and I love the title on this one, Don't Mess with Black Mariah. And yeah, and this one's got our buddy Steve Englehart writing, George Tuska and Billy Graham on art, Mimi Gold colors, letters by John Costanza, and the cover is by Billy Graham as well.
Yeah, old Steve Englehart here, one of our favorite writers. He dialed it up to 11 with the African American slang here, right? Wow, dude, he must have gone into Harlem and stayed somewhere with some folks over there and hung out with them for a couple of weeks and then filled his notebook with his slang because, man, it just comes pouring out of the pages. Every single line uttered by every character is some form of lingo that you'd only hear if you keep watching Superfly on repeat over and over again. But yeah, I love it. So I'm gonna go first with the synopsis, right? Okay, so here we go. Enter Black Mariah. Who is she, and what does this? What is her sinister scheme involving fake ambulances have to do with the man called Cage? Stick around and see Luke take on 400 pounds of jive-talking honey, then get dissed by a horny widow with money to burn. All this and more in this action-packed issue. Can you dig it? And that's it. Oh man,
Oh,
it's great. It's great. So what do you
that's
have for the
crazy.
this is mad.
Okay, the hero for hire gets a phone call for help, but by the time he gets there, the dude is dead. After disposing of the killers, Cage eventually finds out that the architect behind the scheme is a ginormous ton of fun named Black Mariah.
You've got ginormous ton of fun. I've got 400 pounds of jive talking honey. Yeah, man. I mean, that's what she's referred to by Cage. Well, not exactly like that, but he refers to her in this derogatory way. You're referencing her
Oh, yeah.
weight all the time. Damn.
Oh, yeah.
Oh man, it's a great issue. I love it. I love this character of Black Mariah. Of course, she showed up in the Luke Cage Netflix TV show, but she wasn't. They opted to not make her, of course, obese, which was a good decision. I think it plays to a
Right,
certain
yeah.
stereotype, which is reprehensible. But
Yeah.
hey, I mean, the Blob is a giant fat white guy. I mean, I'm overweight. I'm not. I'm just saying, that if they pick a character that's this memorable, even though she might be memorable for the wrong reasons, I'm gonna read it as a product of its time. That's what I'm doing.
Yeah, for 1973 here, it's just, that's not, this wasn't like a big deal. This was just like haha funny. So we don't think it is now, obviously, but in the context of 1973, it was. So yeah, but it's a crazy even to think about, because this woman, it's not like she has any powers or anything like that, or she's a super villain or anything like that at all. She's just a schemer, and she's huge, and she's really strong, because she
That's
throws
right.
around a couple of her lackeys in this too, which is hilarious. I love that scene.
Yeah, I wanted to call her the black female version of the Kingpin, but she's not, Billy, because this scheme of hers, this is a very low rent kind of low level on the totem pole when it comes to crime scheme here. Fake ambulances that take rich folks away before the real when they're injured before the real ambulances arrive, and then they pick the pockets of the rich folk, clean them out, and then dispose of them if just let them die, or and even get the keys from them and to their
Rob
homes
their
and rob their
house and
house. So they're doing
businesses,
they're doing quite well for themselves, because we see later on that Black Mariah and her crew, they've got a parking lot full of sport cars. They've got lots of TVs and high-end furniture in this warehouse where they have their HQ. So it's lucrative. It's just not Kingpin level, of course.
No, not at all.
But in the Luke Cage Netflix TV show, Billy, they do present her as a kind of like a black kingpin. She has that high level of
That's cool.
power. Yeah, she's also a politician, but she's also got her hands in the criminal pies. So fantastic issue. And then, I should mention, if you want to read this, you can do so by reading it in the Power Man Marvel Masterworks Volume 1, Essential Luke Cage Power Man Volume 1, or Luke Cage the Epic Collection called Retribution, which was released, I think, this year. And that's how, you know, I'm reading it at the moment. I don't have the original issue. I do have the Masterworks, but I also have this Retribution trade paperback. And since it was, you know, on the shelf nearest to me, you know, I just grabbed it off, and it's a nice way to read it.
It's great, yeah. Oh, this opening scene too. The guy that called Cage is getting the crap beat out of him. I think they kill the guy right there because the guy takes a lead pipe and smashes him over the head with it.
They do.
And Cage walks in and and sees it going on. He just grabs one guy and tosses him aside like a child. And the other guy, he looks at him and says, "Put it down, pipe man."
Pipe man. Oof. Oh, man, it's a great opening scene. I mean, basically what's happening on the... Because this is in DW's cinema, in the theater, where Luke's supposed to meet this guy on the deserted balcony level. Yeah. And this guy who phoned him, this African-American dude. And as this guy with the lead pipe is killing him, we see on the screen a frontiersman, you know, killing killing an Indian brave, Native American brave with
pistol whipping him.
With his pistol, with the butt of his gun. Just so it's, it mirrors that image. It's great. And Luke arrives, and of course, this even though they've already hit this guy with a lead pipe, this other goon is still pounding on him. And then Luke just tosses him over the balcony, or not over the balcony, over this the row of seats. this goon that's wailing on this dead guy. This guy was dying. And then the guy with the lead pipe hits Luke full on the head. Nothing happens.
No.
Just clud. And Luke just takes a fist, a steel hard fist, to his ribs. Oh, man, that's great. Mm-hmm. And then he slaps the guy for good measure. Luke. And we know how powerful Luke's slaps are. I mean, he almost killed the prison guard, Rackham, with just a slap, you know?
Mm-hmm. And then that other guy comes up creeping up behind him with a knife.
Oh, yeah.
Tries to stab him,
Now, look at this, Billy. Again, the slap that Luke gives to this guy, it's mirrored by the soldier on screen taking out another cowboy. So first he takes out an Indian. So what are we watching? The Lone Ranger here fighting this mean Special Forces type frontiersman here who's taking out Tonto first and then the Lone Ranger. I don't know what we're watching here. But, you know... Luke says, you know, the guy with the knife is going to be handled with a minimum of sweat.
He clobbers that guy, too. Smashes his teeth out, it looks like. And the guy goes through a wall and then out into the audience of the movie.
Now, because of the violence on screen, the patrons of the movie theater, they haven't noticed anything yet. But with Luke putting the full force of his super strength behind this punch, it seems like, because he also rips the guy's clothes as he punches him through the railing on the balcony and towards the screen. This guy must be dead, man.
Probably, right? I mean,
he's punched by Luke at full force, and then he flies over the balcony. And, you know, that's a great panel, too. Fantastically penciled by George Tuska and Billy Graham there.
Yep, great job.
And then, you know... Luke finds the wallet on this dead guy that hired him. He finds his card, and DW shows up, and you know, it's a mystery, because why did he, after all, why did he phone Luke? Why did he want to meet? And what does it have to do with these two goons who tried to kill him, whom I'm pretty sure is dead, Billy? Both of them must be dead, because nothing further is said.
We don't
of them.
See them again.
Yeah.
Yeah, we don't see them ever again, and you feel that they're part of Black Mariah's gang, I think, so I don't know.
Yeah, and the cops don't even show up. I mean, there's no hint of the cops. They're just completely ignoring the trouble in Harlem in this issue. And then, you know, Luke wants to use the payphone, and this one informant of Black Mariah, like you mentioned, he's... Now, here we get some heavy slang. We're getting heavily into the slang. I mean, Luke toned it down when he spoke to DW, to the white folks. But once he hits the black streets here, man, he dials it up to a very high number here. And this goon says, "Keep on rapping, bro. Looks like somebody handed me a chance at some bread, and there ain't no easier way to it than tipping Black Mariah." And then... You know, Luke hits to the payphone. He finds this goon talking to Black Mariah, and he leaves. And then Luke phones the lady, you know, the number he found in the wallet of the dead man who's this very wife. Attractive, yeah. very attractive oh, yeah. African American woman, yeah. woman, and she is upset because she learns that her lover Frank is dead. And oh Lord! So obviously Luke has to meet up with her at one point in time, but he's again when he leaves the theater accosted by this scumbag reporter. Right, Phil Fox from the Daily Bugle, who's dogging his steps. He just doesn't want to let it go. He wants an expose on Luke. And then Luke, after the phone call, returns to DW and said, "Where's the body, man?" And then DW says, "The ambulance came and got in Cage." And Luke's like, "What? But the ambulance never takes away a body before the cops had a look at it, right?" So there's got to be something wrong here. So he kind of like goes off on DW here, right?
Yeah.
But and then he
flips out.
Yeah. So then he runs, tries to catch up to the ambulance, but it's long gone. And then Frank's wife, I think it is, right? Not his girlfriend. His wife shows up, Mrs. Jenks.
Mrs. Jenks. Yeah. No.
Yeah. And then she says, "I'd like to see my husband." And Luke delivers the bad news, because up to this point in time, Luke was not sure that Frank had bit the dust. He wasn't sure that he's dead. I mean, yeah. he suspected. But because of the injuries he sustained, but now he knows for sure, and he lays it on Mrs. Jenks, and she's upset. And then she says, "You know, whatever he wanted to hire you for, Mr. Cage, you know, now I want to change the deal here. I will pay you what Frank promised, but I want you to find out who killed him and why, you know." And then Luke doesn't want to take the money. He just wants to find out really who killed this dude now, but. You know, he says, fine, if she insists, he will take the money. After all, he's the hero for hire. But I think Doug Munch doesn't want it to seem that Luke's too greedy over here, you know, that he's doing it. He wants to show that he's got a hero's soul. So Luke Cage is out for blood, right, Billy? And then then we get the introduction to possibly one of the greatest Luke Cage villains ever. What happens?
Here we go. Well, the ambulance starts going into this abandoned-looking building, and you hear somebody inside say, "Like a greased baby in a herd of pigs."
What the hell does that mean?
That never saw anything easier. Yeah, man, what a haul. Dude got to have some fine spare change. Where's Black Mariah? And the other guy says, "Oh, man, what do you want to rattle her cage for? The fat old cow's eating up half our profits." And just as he's saying that, she comes creeping behind him and grabs him and tosses him up against the wall like 10 feet away.
That's right, and she's wearing the silliest looking dress, Billy, with this massive chain of pearls. It's this red and yellow number with this flowery hat, and she just clobbers this guy with a sweep of her fist. Clud! He flies towards the windows, and she says, "Old Mariah'd never cause you young ones any grief." And then I've given you chillin' good years, ain't I? And you surely ain't the kind to badmouth your Aunt Mariah after. She speaks in this very stereotypical way. With
it Doug almost Munch sounds like she's from Louisiana or something like that to me.
Yeah. I think that's what Doug Munch took for inspiration. Some he probably rewatched Gone with the Wind or something. What was her name? Prissy, played by Butterfly McQueen.
Oh,
classic character, great
crap.
Great Hollywood roles,
name, but
And I don't know, but she speaks like that, like you say, that she's from down south. And then she finds, you know, she's got a watch in her hand, or probably a Rolex or something. She's got like a wad of cash, and then we see a kind of a view of the warehouse, and we learn about their scheme. You know, she just runs over it for our benefit, you know, just reminding these chillin who she just chastised that, you know, they should be grateful for the scheme she concocted with fake ambulances picking up rich folks who are injured before the real ambulance gets there. And then we see all the swag that she's got, these sport cars, you know, the TVs, the typewriters, the fridges, the rifles. I don't know, she's got a lot of stuff from rich folks' homes. And then to emphasize her point, she says, get your lazy tails back to work, you ungrateful punks. And she just takes a fist to this desk and turns it into kindling. Crack.
Yeah. She's not screwing around, man.
She's ridiculously powerful for a mere human.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then Cage.
That's what I'm wondering. Yeah. Is she like a mutant or something? Like you said, like almost like the Blob or something like that. Because the Blob's just not a big fat guy. He's actually a mutant.
No. He's super strong, immovable. Yeah, no, she doesn't have any superpowers per se. She's just like a Kingpin-esque, villain. Marvel in that time thought, huge fat people were super strong. If they could carry around that bulk all day. That's what Marvel just that's just what they thought, Not with the Blob, but definitely with the Kingpin. I mean, the Kingpin though is more believable than Black Mariah because he's had like martial arts training,
Yeah.
and stuff like that. You see him in the Daredevil comics and in Spider-Man too doing that. But here, Black Mariah, man, she's something else. And then Cage shows up to get some information out of this this informant he knows. It was this, just a waiter working in a restaurant, and he's called Flea, right? Flea.
Yeah, Flea.
And Cage is going to use him a couple of times during his run, for information, because Flea knows the
Information.
words on the streets. And of course, he wants to get paid for the information, but Luke's smart. He's savvy, right? Flea says, "Okay, I'll make it worth your while for 50 big ones. I'll tell you what you need to know about these fake ambulances. And check out this warehouse on 17th near 11th." And then Luke says, "Okay, you'll only get your money if this tip is actually worth something."
Yeah.
So
Cage
Flea
is no
gets,
dummy.
yeah, he's no dummy. He gets nothing. I mean, obviously, it is worth something, this tip, but Cage, it does pan out, but he's still not going to pay the guy up front.
No. No, the guy's not going to make him.
Yeah, exactly. So now we get to the fantastic part of this comic, right, Billy? Luke shows up at the warehouse. One of the
Oh my
flunkies of Black
gosh.
Mariah spots him, and Black Mariah calls everyone to her side. She gets them all ready for an ambush as Luke enters this warehouse. And, well, speak on this battle, Billy. This is some fantastic stuff.
Yeah, he comes creeping into the warehouse, and if you remember, it's dark out and there's no lights on in there or anything. So one dude has like, I don't know, like a 2x4 or something like that, and smashes him over the head with it, which of course doesn't do much. And he just punches this guy and knocks him back like, I don't know, 10 or 15 feet, and he says, "What's shaking, baby? Not expecting my body to burst your to bust your club."
And I love the guy who was witness to that punch. The
He's
goon
sweating.
says, yeah, he's sweating. He says, "Jeez, I can't fight that. He'd put distance between me and my teeth."
Yeah, so he starts to kind of lure Cage over to the middle of the room, and there's another dude up top, and there's this giant crate that's roped to the like one of the beams. So that guy cuts it down, and it comes out and smashes Cage, and he says, "You dirty."
Yeah, sweet mama, what was in that crate? The Empire State Building? Now, this crate was filled with some pretty heavy machinery, right? It probably weighed a
It,
couple of
yeah.
tons, and it fell right on top of Luke, but he's fine. Just his shirt's all torn up like it usually, gets during a Luke Cage issue. And then they use this heavy beam as a battering ram, three of them, and run straight at Luke and hits him in the face with this battering ram. And he's seemingly laid out, right, Billy? But we soon realize Luke's just playing possum, right? He wants to pull a fast one on Black Mariah and her crew, so they take the unconscious Luke to her. But he was just playing unconscious, right? So he wakes up, twists his one guy's arm, and then another guy tries to stab him. But before he does that, and he swings this guy into this, I don't know what it is, but it looked like he swung him into a tire, a stack of tires or something. And then his fist heads right for this one guy's face, right? High speed. Thoom! That guy's dead too, Billy. Don't tell me that guy's not, that guy's still alive. I mean, but he smacks him right in the face, and there's almost an explosion of force. This guy goes flying around the room, topples into this stack of appliances. And then Luke doesn't stop there. He picks up this heavy, I don't know, piece of machinery and hurls it at these two guys, and it explodes. Trafoom! Now, okay, those guys might not be dead, but they're seriously injured.
Oh,
Unlike
they're
the
in
one
big
guy,
trouble.
yeah, he just punched. That guy's definitely dead. And then we get to the good stuff, Billy, because now it's Luke Cage versus Black Mariah. Whoa! This is a mean woman here, and she's pulling out a gun on Luke. Bang, pow, wham, crack, bam. That reminds me of some Kirby gun effects, right? Does
And
nothing.
it does nothing to him, and her response is, "You still standing? my boys heist me a pea shooter.
Oh, man, it's cool. And then Luke is heavy on the slang here. He says, don't understand it completely myself, you know, but when I got my mass increased, skin hardness tagged along, slugs just bounce. And then, you know, once he mentions mass, Black Mirai says, hey, you mentioned mass, I've got you beat on that score. And she says, mass means weight. And if you're talking weight, Cage, I got it. And what does Luke think there, Billy? This is, oh man, this is funny. Engelhardt, where did you get your lines from, bud?
Mm-hmm.
You know that panel.
He says, sweet sister, ain't much for hitting women, but if that whale gets me down, she'll do me dirt.
So he crossbody blocks her, and he says, like my man Butkus gonna have to get it. Funt. This is like referring to a football player, right? And then,
oh yeah,
you know, basically she collapses straight through the floor. Brack, coom. And then as she falls to the lower level, Luke says that he thinks that is one big mess of female.
But she notices he won't like fight her, like punch her or kick her or anything like that. So she says, you won't raise a hand to Mariah, huh, boy? I sure am happy to know that about you. Looks like your parents done right raising you up. And then he's like getting kicked. Then she kicks him in the face. That is probably the craziest panel in this whole book.
Yeah, her kicking him in the chin and then thunk, and this the layers of lard hanging off of this leg that George Tuska and Billy Graham drew. It's insane, right? It's insane.
It's crazy. Yeah.
And
it's
then,
wild.
And Luke seems phased. You know, he's definitely groggy from that kick. And then she charges, mm-hmm. shoulder charges him into the wall. Ka-chow! Mm-hmm. You hear me, boy? Only fools die for ideals. And then Luke says, that fat honey must tip in at 400 pounds. Got it all over me there. If my body weren't so tough, I'd be mince pie.
Yep, and then he just basically has his Popeye moment. I couldn't handle no more. So
yeah,
he's gonna fight back against her, which is hilarious in its own right.
Yeah, well, I mean, how does he fight back, Billy? He's still being chivalrous here. She charges him again, but he just sort of steals himself for the blow, mm-hmm. and then she bounces off of his chest, and that hurts her because, you know, this is basically like charging a steel wall. And she got hurt. She basically clutching her stomach there as she flees from him. And she,
well, I think it looks like when she came running in, it looks like he raised his right knee up and hit her in the stomach.
Oh, yeah.
It kind of looks like.
Yeah. You're right.
And he says, let her do the exercising and the moaning.
Uh-huh. Oh, I feel it for Black Mariah here, right? Because she's definitely now, you know, she's been injured seriously, probably. Mm-hmm. So she runs for it, and then she can book because she's booking across this dock. And Lute says, "Shoot, stumpy legs still can pump. She gonna make it." And she jumps in the speedboat. But Luke's not letting her go. He goes all Spider-Man-like and swings from the rafters on this dock. Mm-hmm. And then he leaps from this, second level of the pier? He leaps straight onto, now we know Luke weighs 300 pounds. So since he's got the height, this is believable. He, you know, plunges down on top of Mariah's speedboat. And like a seesaw, you know, throws her into the air once this boat collapses into the water. Mm-hmm. And she's in the water, and then we don't see more, but presumably the cops show up to arrest her, because now she's waterlogged, she's stuck, she has no means of escape. And she says, Cage, you son of a sow. And he says, button it, you float real good with your lard, lady, but I'll be happy to come over and dunk you once or twice. Woo. Now, you know, the very next panel just shows Cage striding through Times Square, or well, obviously this is the Harlem Strip, but it almost looks like, the way it's painted, looks like Times Square, and this hot babe just ogles him, because after all, he's shirtless, steel hard muscles on full display, and then, you know, Flea shows up, Cage, where's my bread? And he refuses to pay him. Cage doesn't...
Yeah.
You know, even though his tip turned out to be good, He said, "Your tip wasn't worth any more than a donut hole." What? Come on. I mean, come on. Flea did you a solid there, Cage, by giving you the address to that warehouse, right?
You know, he tries to, like, go around it and say, like, oh, you know, you gave me the wrong address because it was, like, you know, the next building over. And it's like, come on, dude. You can leave, well, give him 25 then. Put you in the right direction.
Yeah, I mean, technically, Flea still gets his money, but now this next scene is crazy. Mrs. Jenks shows up, and she's more than willing to pay Cage, but damn, she can't keep her eyes off his muscles, right, Billy? Look at that.
Yeah.
And she even hesitates when she speaks to him, right? She says, "Mr. Cage, is that you? And then she is clearly drawn that she's, you know, got her eyes locked on his pecs. And she says, I came for your report on my husband." You know, and Cage just still got his eyes on Flea here. And Flea acts as Cage's agent. He says, "That'll be 50 bills, lady." And then Mrs. Jenks is upset. She says, "He said no charge." And and Flea just says, "He didn't mean it. Cough up the money." And "Cool out, Flea," says Cage. But now Mrs. Jenks is already hurt. She thinks Luke isn't a man of his word. She tosses the money in his face. And even though she was amorously inclined towards Cage here, even just with her husband dead, just a couple of hours dead, Flea gets what he wants. He gets his 50 bucks, and Luke just says, "Hero for hire, huh? What a dandy racket." Yeah. And then
I love it.
Yeah, she calls him a snake. What's next, Billy? That is a brilliant title. Read that for us.
Next. Knights and White Satin.
Oh, that's brilliant. I love that title. Gosh. Obviously, Knights written with a K. And instead of Knights in White Satin, like the classic song.
This is Moody Blues.
Moody Blues. Oh, man, I love that song. This is Knights and White Satin. That's going to be good. So another great issue to look forward to. And the funny one is it actually features a knight that Luke's going to battle. But hardly any White Satin, though, unless you want to use White Satin as the you know, the metaphor for a pretty, you know, Caucasian lady who's sort of in the next issue. There's no White Satin to be had. I don't know why. It must be slang for a pretty white lady, right?
Yeah, I mean, and it's the it's a Christmas one too, so look out.
Ooh, yeah, sweet Christmas, a sweet Christmas issue. Oh man, Billy, I enjoyed this thoroughly. You know, these Luke Cage issues are really contenders. You know, when it comes to picking a favorite for Dragons and Jive every month, I love the Shang-Chi. You know, I'm Shang-Chi first and foremost, but damn, these Luke Cage issues want to steal the first spot on the list here every damn time.
Yep. I've been more leaning towards the Shang-Chi's, but this week might be different. I shouldn't say this week. This episode might be different.
Yeah,
much fun.
It's got Black Mariah. Yeah, this is definitely at the top of the list this week. For the first time, I think Luke Cage is going to take the top spot from Shang-Chi here. And then, you know, we're hitting straight on to Iron Fist. Now, you can definitely see an improvement in this Iron Fist issue, Billy, because now we're getting to... We're introduced to one of the stalwarts, supporting characters in Iron Fist's mythology, if you want to call it that. And that is, of course, a lady I've been in love with since I was a little kid, Colleen Wing. And in fact, Misty Knight, which we'll see later on. We've already seen her a little in the Bronze Age at this point in time. But she's also going to be one of my long, love affairs in my head, at least. You know, Misty Knight and Colleen Wing. The double act that they have together in the Iron Fist comic. I just love those two ladies. But yeah, Colleen Wing shows up. So now the Iron Fist stories are getting more interesting. Okay, Billy, it's my turn, right, to give some details on this issue of Marvel Premiere. Specifically, this is issue 19. And cover dated November 1974. On sale August the 27th, 1974. Cover art by Jim Starlin. And inked by Al Milgram. And the title of this story is Death Cult. Writer Doug Munch. And we just saw Doug on Master of Kung Fu. He didn't do the Luke Cage issue. But we're doing Doug Munch twice every time we do Dragons and Jive, right, Billy? He was penciling. Yeah. That he was the choice writer for these kind of martial arts style issues. Okay, so mm-hmm. we've got Larry Hama penciling again, Dick Giordano inking him, lettered by Raymond Holloway, colored by Jan Brunner. Jan Brunner? What? Is that mm-hmm. Frank Brunner's wife?
Can it be? I'm not sure. I saw that as well, and I was like, what's going on here? And I thought, I have no idea.
Okay, we have to do some more research on this. Expect some more on this during the next issue of Dragons and Jive patrons, because, damn, I want to find out more about that. It seemed that every... other, I mean, Roy had Dan Thomas co-writing his wife sometimes, and Bill Mantlo, you know, had Karen Mantlo doing some lettering. What? Everybody brought their wife or girlfriend along. I mean, Steve Gerber had Mary Screens. You know, what was happening here at Marvel?
Yeah, who knows, right?
Yeah, so if you want to read along with us, you can do so on the Marvel app, or you can do with the Iron Fist Masterworks Volume 1. It's also been collected in Iron Fist's Epic Collection, The Fury of Iron Fist trade paperback, and the Essential Iron Fist Volume 1 trade paperback if you're up for some black and white awesomeness. And I really dig this cover by Starlin, Billy. But before we get into the cover, maybe I should say we should do the synopsis first. Okay, Billy, what do you have for the synopsis for Iron Fist in Marvel Premiere 19?
All right, after leaving Meacham Industries, he's met in the streets by Colleen Wing. Her father sent her there to bring Iron Fist to him and tell him about the cult of Kara Kai. Iron Fist then gets ambushed by a group of assassins, but then he is aided by a mysterious ninja.
Yeah, the same ninja that helped him out in the previous issues, and the same one that murdered Harold Meacham. And we're going to find out this ninja has strong ties to Colleen's dad, Professor Meacham. I'm not going to give Professor Wing. I'm not going to give anything away yet. But yeah, it's kind of freaky once we learn the true origin of this ninja. My synopsis goes as follows, Billy. Now, the number one suspect in the murder of Harold Meacham, Danny, meets Colleen Wing and her father, the Professor, who are plagued by the death cult of Kara Kai. A conversation with Joy Meacham leads to Danny walking into a trap in an abandoned arcade. He squares off against multiple assassins, but he's again saved by the mysterious ninja, whose calling card this time around appears to be a bloody newspaper heralding a manhunt for Iron Fist. So, a more enjoyable issue, I'm sure you'd agree, Billy. What did you think overall of the story and the art?
Yeah, I like this one a good bit. This is my favorite so far.
Yeah,
you know,
it's
definitely the best effort so far. I think, you know, Doug Mensch and Larry Hama and Dick Giordano here are starting to get the wheels turning real good. And, you know, good story, good dialogue, good artwork. I really like it a lot. And I like in this one, too, how, you know, some of these assassins that Iron Fist ends up fighting at this abandoned arcade, they give him a run for his money, and it looks like they're going to, you know, kind of lay a bit of a beating on him before the ninja shows up to kind of give him a hand.
Yeah, he ultimately gets out of that scrape, you know, on his own, but it did really seem like he was on the ropes there, yeah. Literally on the ropes, because they had him strung up there. I should amend that, though, Billy. I'm still going to pick a Marvel Premiere number 15 as my favorite. You know, the origin of Iron Fist, one of the great origins of Marvel and the Bronze Age, you know. This is my second favorite Iron Fist comic of the run so far, because damn, that origin story was pretty damn good. You remember the one penciled by Gil Kane and where, you know, the mom and dad perish and the wolves chase them down. Oh, that's a great origin. Yeah. But then we had three or, you know, so weak issues, and now we've got this issue coming along. So yeah, definite improvement. And Jim Starlin on the cover, man, I love it when he draws, you know, martial arts. I just dig it. And obviously, he's one of the creators of Master of Kung Fu.
Yep.
So he excels at this type of action scene. Shang-Chi taking out three assassins, and then the ninja lurking in the background. But it seems that the ninja is holding, a foil, a fencing foil. You know, one of the fencing swords rather than a katana or something that he...
he's not in all black either, like he is in the comic, I think.
Yeah. So a little bit of discrepancy there on the cover. But, you know, I'm loving the corner box art with Iron Fist there. I love the lettering on his logo. Marvel Premier featuring Iron Fist with these bolts, you know.
Rivets,
Rivets, sorry, soldered in on the edges there. It's amazing. Yep. And then, you know, it opens with some pretty good Larry Hama art on the splash panel of the first page where Joy's still vowing revenge, Iron Fist's leaving. And then in the background, we see, of course, the dead Harold Meacham with the sword still impaling him to his wheelchair. But the wall mural, it's not the wall mural, obviously. This is a yin-yang symbol, but it's a very, you know, twisty kind of effect. It looks almost like the yin-yang's melting or moving, right, Billy, in this weird color scheme that they have. It's fantastic. And then Death Cult written above it as the name of the story. I love this first opening page. What do you think?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, it's really, really good. What's her name there? Looks really hot too.
Joy Meacham. Oh man, she is. Yeah. She's very, very pretty and very alluring.
Oh my gosh,
she scolds him. She said, I love the way her words that she picks here. She says, "That's right, Mr. Flashy Iron Fist. Crawl away. But no matter how deep a hole you squirm into, I'll dig you out and make you pay for murdering my father." Mr. Flashy Iron Fist.
Yeah, she's pissed, and then she calls up her uncle?
Yeah,
and
her
and
brother.
About,
her brother. Oh yeah, yeah. No, sorry. It's her uncle Ward. Yeah, she says your brother's dead, Uncle Ward. Yeah, you're right. It's her uncle.
And that guy, I guess, had Meacham kind of had a contingency plan if this was going to happen with his brother there on how to deal with Iron Fist.
That's right. That's right. And you know, he's obviously got a lot of plans. You know, he says evil as Harold Meacham, presumably. And he promises to help her out. And then we see Danny in the street. It's raining. He's met by this lady with an umbrella. And, you know, she says, "Listen, you know, I'm Colleen Wing. And, you know, I've got some clothes for you. Because, you know, after all, you need a disguise so the cops won't arrest you." And she hands him this fedora and this coat. And she says, before she gives him the clothes, she says, "You look like a harlequin." What? Yeah. Not really. No. I don't know what kind of harlequins Colleen's used to.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a bizarre response.
It's a very bizarre line there from her. And then she hails the cab. They climb in the cab together, you know, and they, you know, the taxi driver is very rude. I mean, Colleen gives him the address, Riverside Drive, 111th Street driver, and he's just, you know, like, scoffs at her. And then she starts talking to him about her father and why she's helping him. Mm-hmm. And he gratefully accepted her help. He was a little bit suspicious in the beginning, but then just, I mean, it's probably because of her looks. Because Colleen is a beautiful lady, right? Oh, I'll climb into a car with her, whether she wants to take my life or not. I don't mind. I'll follow her to the ends of the earth. And then she starts telling him in the cab ride over to her house about her father. And that he knew Wendell Rand, and he knows about Danny and Kung Lun, and you know, and everything basically. And she says her father's a great man, but he's in trouble. You know, he's being plagued by the death cult of Kurakai. Mm-hmm. And then now this is really weird, Billy. Right when they arrive at Colleen's home, this scene is almost too strange to be believed. Two assassins from Kurakai attack Iron Fist while Colleen is walking right in front of him and unlocking the door to her home. And he blocks their hurled daggers with his Kung Fu mastery. And then they were also sporting umbrellas. The daggers are deflected back into the umbrellas by Iron Fist. But then the Kurakai assassins just fade. They just disappear. There's decidedly Indian, you know, Middle Eastern Indian-looking type assassins. And then they vanish. And Colleen Wing didn't hear a thing. She doesn't know what happened. And, you know, she's a highly... We'll find out she's highly trained in the martial arts as well later on. But she's probably not... She doesn't have the sense of unagi, which is this awareness about her that martial artists need, because she didn't even hear a whisper of this attack. And Iron Fist doesn't say anything about it to her. And then we get to meet Professor Wing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he's a student of, you know, Eastern myths, and he mm-hmm. knows all about Kung Lun. And
yeah.
Then he discusses his, you know, archaeological digs in Asia with Iron Fist and how they found this book. Now, Billy, we know that this is impossible. You can't find a perfectly preserved book underneath the ground. It would crumble into dust.
Yeah.
No, it's impossible. And the diggers who were with him warned him that there would be a curse on the book. And in mm-hmm. fact, that's when he discovered this book. That's when he became a target of the Kurakai cult. And they mm-hmm. tried to assassinate him that very night, but he had a gun handy and just blasted this guy. You know, so yeah. Professor Wing can take care of himself, huh?
And he's no dummy.
Yeah, he learned from that book, though, that the city of Kung Lun exists. So he went into the Himalayas, you know, to... he was in India digging at the time, so he left India and went into mm-hmm. the Himalayas to find out if this legend of Kung Lun was true. And he met the monk called Datempa, who was dying from a rock slide. And Datempa told him about mm-hmm. the city of Kung Lun. And we met Datempa in a previous issue, right? The last issue, in fact.
Yeah.
You know, where he was admitted yep. to Kung Lun and briefly mm-hmm. stayed. And he saw Daniel Rand being trained by Lei Kung, the Thunderer. And
oh, yeah.
And he also knew the story of Danny Rand, you know, the little boy seeking, possibly going to one day grow up to seek revenge against the man who murdered his parents. And, you know, before he died, he told this entire story to Professor Wing.
Yeah.
You know, now, Professor Wing, of course, and Colleen Wing, they're of Japanese descent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can see they're drawn to look Asian. And... you know, that's how Professor Wing got to know about Iron Fist and how he knew exactly where Iron Fist would be, you know, after 10 years. Because he knew that Iron Fist would leave Kung Lun after 10 years of training to get revenge on Meacham. That's why he had Colleen meet him outside of Meacham Tower. So very, I mean, wow, this guy must be, I don't know, an astrologer or something, or not that astrology works, it's BS. But I mean, he must be really good at calculating, you know, probabilities or movements here.
he puts the Clock King to shame.
Yeah, there you go. Wow, if this guy turned to crime, oof, it would take someone even better than Batman to catch him. But, you know, Iron Fist decides to accept the help from Professor Meacham. And I keep calling him Professor Meacham. Professor Wing, for God's sake. And he wants mm-hmm. to talk to Joy Meacham. So Professor Wing just said, okay, if you want to smooth things over with Joy, why don't you just look her up in the phone book? And that's when...
Give her a buzz.
Yeah, give her a buzz on the phone. And Iron Fist feels very unfamiliar with the phone because, after all, he hasn't used one in 10 years.
No.
And he dials up Joy, and Joy says, all right, if you want to talk, meet me at this arcade on 42nd Street. Now, we know this is a trap. Professor Wing warns Iron Fist against this. And he says, you'll need a subway token to get there, kid. And he tosses him a subway token. And then Iron Fist takes off. And then, of course, Joy Meacham sets the murderous plan in action here that she's cocked up with mm-hmm. her uncle. And they send these assassins to meet Danny at the arcade. Now, Billy, at first, where Harry enters, there's shades of Westworld. You know, the movie with Yul Brynner. Because when he enters this arcade, this cowboy draws on him, right? And, and Iron Fist just reacts, punches this cowboy in the face, and it turns out this was just a fast draw, you know, automaton.
A game.
Yeah. And he punches this. It breaks the neck of this puppet or this mannequin. And then he's accosted by four highly trained assassins. We've got... two guys sporting size, like Electra style,
mm-hmm.
and two sporting these hooks on these lengths of rope that they're... they're obviously trained in the use of these instruments. So, Billy, speak about this.
Yeah, one end has just like a grappling hook on the end of the chain, and the other end has... I can't remember what the name of that is. That's some kind of ninja weapon, I think. It's definitely... a legit weapon. I've seen that before.
Yeah. Same.
And
here,
I can't think of what it is, but yeah, they all four of them, like, they're, again, they're pretty tough. So they all try to come at him at once, and he starts to do pretty good here in the beginning, but then, you know, they end up getting the drop on him, and the two guys with the chains or ropes or whatever, and the grappling hooks, they both get them around each of his arms, you know, and they're like pulling each way, kind of like almost like in a crucifix type position. And then the other two guys with the sai are coming in from the opposite ends, and they're going to try to, you know, do them in. And then we see right outside this room, there are three more guys waiting. And they say, oh, it looks like we won't be needed after all. And then, huh? And they turn around, and that ninja shows up again, and he takes all three of them out, like, in no time flat. I don't know if he kills the one or two of them, though.
Yeah, it probably does. I mean, he's killed, you know, multiple times before, so... He does. Yeah. I mean, he slashes this one guy with his katana. The guy who first blocked him with a chain. He also slashed this other guy across the chest. Now it's bloodless as it's drawn here, but I'm pretty sure those two guys are dead.
And, yeah, I don't think they're alive.
No, Iron Fist is more merciful though. He escapes from being caught between these two assassins, you know, who have pinioned his arms with these ropes. But he's strong enough to pull them. You know, Batman style. I've seen Batman do that multiple times, right, Billy, when he's in that situation. He pulls the ropes together and you just, you know, the two guys collide with each other. And then, you know, they headbutt each other and they're out. And then he leaps over those two guys in the center and kicks the other two Psy-wielding assassins in the face.
Oh, split kick, yeah.
Fantastic panel there. Progression of panels there by Larry Hama. Mm-hmm. And so he's face-to-face with the ninja again. And the only thing the ninja does to communicate, he's mute or something. He's wordless. He tosses a paper, a newspaper that he uses to wipe the blood off his blade. That's why I'm thinking he killed those guys, right?
Yeah.
His blade is all bloody, but he wipes it clean with this newspaper and tosses it at Iron Fist. And Iron Fist reads the headline, Iron Fist sought in Meacham murder. And this huge blood splatter on this paper. And the ninja leaves. And what do we get next issue, Billy?
Batroc's Brigade.
Aha! Batroc, Captain America villain. Batroc the Leaper. Oh, he's a perfect foe for Iron Fist. Let's see how his skills stack up to Iron Fist's. That's a great issue, actually, Billy. A lot of fun, you know, and it's this time the writing team will change next issue, I should say.
Whole new creative team here. Tony Isabella, Arvel Jones. Yeah, looking forward to it.
Yeah, man, it's fun, and it's... totally different look to Iron Fist, and I kind of liked it. I just didn't like the coloring on that issue. They screwed up his green a little, but it's still fine. There's lots of action, lots of Batroc style shenanigans going on there. You know, we're used to seeing some weird. I mean, I love the way Kirby penciled Batroc fighting Captain America. You know, and this is very, very Kirby inspired action panels, even though the arc doesn't really look Kirby, but the anatomy's all over the place. So I guess it is a bit of Kirby in there. So lots to look forward to there, patrons. And Billy, that brings us to the end of another Dragons and Jive. But before we say goodbye, let's pick our favorites here. Mm-hmm. Okay, first off, favorite cover, and then we'll do favorite issue as a whole. What was your favorite cover of the bunch?
Well, this is going to be a clean sweep for me. I have to go with Luke Cage number 5 just because of the character on the cover.
Dude, there you go. That's
I can't. I have to.
That cover is legitimately great. I mean, we've got fantastic action on the Shang-Chi cover and the Iron Fist cover, but no real, you know, jaw-dropping image that is, you know, sort of that blows you away. But the Luke Cage cover with Black Mariah showing up there, and Luke
sort of
beating off her goons there, but his shirt is ripped. And I just love the way George Tuska draws Luke Cage. It's amazing. And then Black Mariah lurking in the background. How can you not pick this cover? It's just, it's ridiculous.
It's the best.
And Luke Cage is also my favorite corner box art at this point in time. You know, I like the Iron Fist. I dig the Master of Kung Fu immensely. But this Luke Cage is just that iconic image of Luke just shouting up at the man standing there in the corner box art. So yeah, definitely, Billy, I'm in full agreement. Now let's get to our favorite issue.
Oh, easily it's Luke Cage number 5. And I loved Shang-Chi. And again, I even said, you know, Marvel Premiere 19, it is the best so far, you know, the Iron Fist. But I just can't. Luke Cage was just so funny and hilarious. I love the way it's written, and then the artwork was really good. I thought it was really on point.
Fantastic. No. I'm also going to go for the Luke Cage issue. We're in full agreement here, Billy. But I'm not going to say it's easily Luke Cage like you did. This is definitely very close. You know, if I had to give Shang-Chi a score out of 10, I'd say 8.5 out of 10. Luke Cage would be a 9. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so very, very close. But Luke Cage for me as well, just because of Black Mariah and because of the far-out jive talk and slang that Engelhardt brought to the table. And then, of course, the fantastic art by Tuska and Billy Graham just bringing it every single issue. And Luke Cage is just, you know, looking better and better. Mm-hmm. And also the weird, funny moments that are inserted here, right, Billy? I mean, Iron Fist has almost no funny moments, whereas Shang-Chi has some funny bits, but it's more tragedy in that issue, you know, with the death of Diana. And then Luke Cage, though, it's got everything. It's got tragedy in the form of Mrs. Jenks' dead husband. It's got the funny bits with the ladies all ogling Cage's steel-skinned bod. And then, of course, Black Mariah brings the funny, but also, you know, she's just a big bag of mean. And you really feel like Luke had his work cut out for him dealing with that jive talking honey. So amazing. How could you not pick that issue? Lots of fun. Yeah. Okay, so Billy, we're going to thank our patrons again for supporting us and making this show possible. Thank you guys sticking with us, and we always appreciate that, of course. And we'll be back, you know, in a month's time with some more Dragons and Jive. But look for House of Licensed Ideas episode 5, as well as Radio Free Hyboria episode 5, which will be available in the month of October, in the first week of October, same as this episode. Mm-hmm. Okay, Baliso, I'm gonna bid everyone farewell, and you too, my brother. And we'll meet up again in the mean streets of Harlem, or on the beaches of Florida, or in the shark tanks of Florida, I should say, when next we get together again to record another Dragons and Jive. So that's it for me.
All right, take care.